Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It's building relationships, it's building trust, it's treating people with respect. That's how I tried to carry myself in the legislature.
A third Democrat joins a crowded race to be Alaska's next governor. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, an effort to remove one of the state's most prolific murderers from a veterans cemetery in Sitka.
The fact that he was able to be buried there under some kind of legal loophole just really didn't seem right.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The U.S. Senate today confirmed Aaron C. Peterson of Anchorage to be a federal district court judge in Alaska. The vote was 58-39, with 7 Democrats voting yes. Peterson is in his mid-40s and was born in Anchorage. He's an Air Force veteran and has worked at the State Department of Law since 2012. Before that, he clerked in the Alaska Superior Court. At his Senate confirmation hearing last year, Peterson spoke of retired Superior Court Judge Michael Spann as a role model.
Judge Spann approached his work diligently, with humility, and always respecting every litigant that appeared before him. I took so much away from that clerkship, and I've carried those lessons with me every day since.
Peterson, once he's sworn in, will be the first judge to go through an advisory committee Senator Dan Sullivan established to help select candidates for Alaska's federal court. And he'll be Alaska's first new federal judge since U.S. District Court Judge Joshua Kindred resigned amid allegations of impropriety with law clerks and attorneys. Like Peterson, Kindred had the support of both U.S. senators and was nominated by President Trump. Alaska's U.S. District Court still has 1 vacancy. Former Sitka State Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins entered the race for governor this week. He's the third Democrat to file alongside nearly a dozen Republicans vying for the role. Christ Tompkins announced his candidacy before an audience of around 70 supporters in Sitka today. He said if elected, he'd approach the position the same way he tackled his work in the legislature, finding compromises across the aisle.
It's not like you're throwing bombs or putting out red meat press releases or calling people names. I don't think that gets you anywhere. It's building relationships, it's building trust, it's treating people with respect. That's how I tried to carry myself in the legislature. And I think if we have a governor who can take that approach, there's a lot of good that can happen for Alaska.
In 2012, Christ Tompkins dropped out of Yale at the age of 22 to run for public office. He narrowly beat the Republican incumbent, winning his seat in the Alaska House of Representatives by just 32 votes. He spent a decade in that role, representing Sitka and other Southeast communities. Christ Tompkins said while he thinks the legislature is in the best place it's been since the 1990s with its strong bipartisan coalition, the budget is another story. Last month, Governor Mike Dunleavy proposed a plan to bring in more revenue for the state, including introducing a temporary state sales tax and oil tax increase. Christ Tompkins says there are parts of Dunleavy's proposal he would take and parts he would leave, but ultimately the question of balancing the state's finances will take compromise and new leadership.
I mean, I think it's good he's putting stuff out there. A little rough that that's happening 8 years into an 8-year tenure. Unfortunately, I think things are at a place between the governor and the legislature that it's pretty unlikely that anything is going to happen this year.
Last year, the legislature overrode the governor's veto to increase school funding, but with increasing costs year by year, school districts are still facing budget shortfalls. Christ Tompkins said he'd like to reduce budget uncertainty for school districts by passing a constitutional amendment to fund schools a year in advance, so schools are not basing their budgets on a moving target.
The timing of the budget process is insane, where school boards literally have to guess the number that's going to come out of Juneau while they're finalizing their budgets. And again, more money, less money, whatever, but like don't do it at the 11th hour. And it's actually like a pretty simple change that can just do a tremendous amount of good in terms of reducing uncertainty.
At the kickoff event, Christ Tompkins told supporters that they've raised over $400,000 for his campaign so far. Christ Tompkins is the 16th candidate to file for the governor's race. In Alaska, the top four vote earners advance from the August primary to the general election in November, regardless of political party. The council that manages Alaska's federal fisheries might be just days away from a decision that could limit the amount of chum salmon that the Bering Sea trawl fleet is allowed to scoop up as bycatch. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the move comes after years of calls for change from tribes who say they bear the brunt of conservation in the face of sustained salmon crashes.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council will weigh five options for dealing with chum salmon bycatch at its meeting in Anchorage this week. Tribal nonprofits and advocacy groups that represent a vast swath of Western Alaska and Western Interior communities have mostly aligned around a combination of restrictions: a hard cap on all chum bycatch, a more severe hard cap where Western Alaska chum are most prevalent, and strengthening the incentive-based regulations already used by the Pollock fleet. During advisory panel testimony ahead of the main council meeting, Caitlin Yeager with the At-Sea Processors Association, a trade group representing factory trawlers in the Pollock fleet, said that putting a cap on chum bycatch across the entire fishery could be catastrophic.
These hard caps are indiscriminate, triggering full shutdowns even when vessels are operating far outside of the times and areas where Western Alaska chum are at risk.
The Pollock industry says severe chum restrictions would mean hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue. Leaders in the Pollock-dependent community of Unalaska also say a hard cap on chum bycatch would likely shut down the fishery early and bring serious economic consequences. Some Western Alaska communities are also heavily invested in the Pollock industry through a long-running federal community development quota program, which channels profits into economic growth and education. The volume of chum bycatch recorded in the Pollock fishery has dropped significantly in recent years, but last year that number bumped up to a little more than 150,000 fish. Federal fisheries managers contend that roughly just 17% of those chums on average over the last decade were bound for Western Alaska rivers. Yeager with the At-Sea Processors Association advocated for codifying current voluntary rules she says the Pollock fleet has already implemented, and she said the costs of more severe restrictions could outweigh the benefits for Western Alaska chum.
And if you or the council select a hard cap approach, it must be transparent about the trade-offs involved and the limited biological effect benefit that they are expected to provide.
But tribal members from the state's hardest hit waterways, like Charlie Wright Sr. from the Upper Yukon River, told the panel that every salmon counts.
I'd just like to see some fish get back on the spawning ground so future generations can enjoy it. I ain't trying to make money off of it. I just want to eat.
Wright is Athabascan and chairs the Fish Commission that advocates for dozens of Yukon River tribes now entering their seventh year of total salmon fishing closures.
And a lot of villages that don't have a store, they don't have boats and motors, there's no economy. So they're kind of pushed right back against the wall with no other means.
Crystal Lapp, a policy analyst with the Tanana Chiefs Conference, said salmon closures have caused measurable harm in the Yukon River communities her tribal consortium represents. She testified not only about the loss of subsistence, but also the loss of the river's commercial salmon fishery.
Over the last 6 years, closures have cost our region an estimated $27 million in direct income.
On the Kuskokwim River, where commercial fishing has also collapsed, there are still opportunities to harvest Chinook and chum. But Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission Chair Martin Andrew testified that severe restrictions have taken a toll.
There's no more commercial fishing income. We struggle to put food away for the winter and have enough to share in our limited subsistence opportunities. Our physical, mental, and spiritual health is in crisis.
Any decision by the council to tighten bycatch restrictions wouldn't likely go into place for at least a year, and the effects would take years to assess. But residents from communities along the Kuskokwim, in Norton Sound, and along the Yukon River looking for any means of putting salmon in their smokehouses say the clock is ticking. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the colorful backstory behind the Nome National Forest.
I think he just likes the quirkiness of it and knows that it's fun for visitors.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
One of Alaska's most prolific murderers is buried in a place of honor in a cemetery for veterans in Sitka. Michael Silka's grave is just a stone's throw from the Alaska State Troopers Academy. This is especially galling to law enforcement officers who have trained at the academy over the past four decades because the final person Silka killed was a state trooper. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports on one man's quest to right what he sees as a grave injustice.
Grant Cooper of Anchorage has worked in law enforcement at all levels, from village public safety officer to the federal government. He remembers the first time he trained at the Alaska Public Safety Academy in Sitka in 2003 and toured the attached museum.
There's a memorial plaque to Trooper Troy Lynn Duncan, the state trooper that was killed in the shootout with Silka. And they also had the rifle on display in the Trooper Museum, still with the evidence tag on it.
Cooper learned the story of Silka's killing spree from his instructor at the academy. Silka, a drifter and self-described mountain man, is believed to have killed nine Alaskans in 1984. The first was his neighbor in the Chena Ridge area of Fairbanks. A few weeks later, in the course of an afternoon, seven residents of the interior town of Manly Hot Springs were killed or disappeared. The Alaska State Troopers mounted a search for Silka. Trooper Duncan was in a helicopter that spotted him. Both the officer and the suspect were killed in the shootout. Nearly 20 years had passed by the time Cooper's instructor at the academy told him the story.
And mentioned that Silka was buried in the National Cemetery adjacent to the Trooper Academy about 100 yards away.
Cooper was stunned. He had to see it for himself.
It's a fairly small cemetery, quite beautiful. But just to see his white headstone next to all these other, you know, veterans that served honorably, and the fact that he was able to be buried there under some kind of legal loophole just really didn't seem right.
Cooper started writing his congressional delegation, mostly to no avail. It would take an act of Congress to force Silka's removal. A law already bans burying serious criminals in national cemeteries, but it doesn't apply retroactively as far back as Silka's case. Cooper let it rest for years, but restarted his campaign in 2023. He was surprised to get a response from Senator Lisa Murkowski's office.
I was pretty impressed. I got probably a call back from her aide within 5 days, and he sounded, you know, very passionate and like, hey, this is we can do this.
Fellow officers and academy alumni had raised the same issue over the years. They told him not to get his hopes up. And their skepticism seemed warranted as months and years passed. And then last fall,
I happen to be reading the news, and I'm like, wait a second, this exact same thing is happening in Texas.
A Vietnam veteran who was an alleged serial killer will have his remains removed from this Texas cemetery. Fernando Cota.
U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas got a provision added to a defense bill last year to remove a murderer's remains from Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery. Murkowski noticed. She's offered previous measures to have Silka removed, and she says she isn't giving up now.
Yes, he was a service member very early on in his life, but he went on to murder a law enforcement officer.
Murkowski, Cornyn, and senators from four other states have a bill that would allow the Department of Veterans Affairs to disinter the remains of people like Silka, who'd be ineligible for burial honors under current law due to serious crimes. The bill has had one committee hearing. Murkowski thinks it's likely it could pass as an attachment to other legislation. The VA says Silka is one of at least seven deceased veterans across the country whose remains could be removed from their place of honor if the law allows it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The New York Times reported Tuesday that 11th Airborne Division soldiers from Alaska have been told to stand down after receiving orders last month to prepare to deploy to Minnesota. The story in the Times said the U.S. Northern Command quietly ordered the active duty troops on standby to stand down last weekend. It cited an unnamed source who spoke on condition of anonymity to talk about the operation. The Northern Command is the 11th Airborne's higher headquarters. The Pentagon placed more than 1,500 11th Airborne soldiers on heightened alert in mid-January. The orders were to prepare for deployment to Minnesota to support the federal immigration crackdown that was provoking mass protests and violent clashes. The division has some 12,000 soldiers, most of whom are stationed at its headquarters at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and at Fort Wainwright. The Times story said 11th Airborne soldiers from North Carolina also were ordered to stand down. A division spokesperson on Tuesday referred questions about the stand-down report to the White House press office, but as of this afternoon, the office has not yet responded to those queries. Representatives from the mining industry gathered in Vancouver, British Columbia last week for an annual conference. But opponents of a mineral exploration project outside Haines seized on the opportunity for their own purposes. They launched an ad campaign to send one key message: leave our valley. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt reports.
In 2024, the Chilkat Indian Village launched an effort to lead public opposition to the Palmer Project. That's a zinc, copper, gold, silver, and barite exploration site upstream of the native village of Klukwan. The project has changed hands a number of times since then. That included in November, when Vancouver-based mineral exploration company Vizsla Copper acquired the project and declared its intent to earn community approval. Chilkat Indian Village President Kimberly Strong says the tribe has ramped up its messaging in response.
We just want to make it very clear that there isn't social licensing here in the Chilkat Indian Village.
The effort entailed placing ads on digital screens around the conference, which was put on by the British Columbia Association for Mineral Exploration. They also placed full-page ads in the Vancouver Sun, the Seattle Times, and the Anchorage Daily News. In bold, all-caps text, the ad reads, "No means go." Below that, in orange, it says, "Leave our valley." The group communicated the same message in a video released late last month.
Vizsla Copper Corporation, we said no to mines here. That should be enough. The Chilkat Valley in Southeast Alaska is our home, where the clean rivers and lands have sustained our way of life since time immemorial. We don't want a mine.
The campaign came the same week that Vizsla announced general plans for the project for this year and touted a formal letter of support from Governor Mike Dunleavy. Dunleavy pledged his, quote, full support for the project in a letter dated January 22, according to a copy obtained by KHNS. He added that the project stands to, quote, strengthen Alaska's role in meeting federal mining objectives while also benefiting the state itself. During a public speech in Vancouver last week, Vizsla CEO Craig Perry said Dunleavy had requested a meeting with him in Juneau.
I've never seen such great access to government and to the permitting authorities. So the fact that, you know, we've been on the ground here a month now and the governor of Alaska has asked for a meeting in Juneau is an extraordinary outcome to my mind.
The company is still finalizing the details of its plans for the summer, but has brought on several contractors, Vizsla said in a release last week. That includes a $600,000 contract with a marketing company it says will carry out a, quote, comprehensive media marketing campaign. As to this summer's exploration efforts, the company plans to conduct up to 10,000 meters of diamond drilling focused on copper, zinc, silver, and gold. The company also plans to focus more on barite and for the first time include the mineral in the project's overall value estimate. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
An Anchorage police sergeant has been arrested and charged with operating under the influence. In a statement Tuesday, Anchorage police said 41-year-old Corey Adkins was off duty at the time. The statement says officers responded around 3 a.m. on January 31st to a report of a vehicle in distress near Mirror Lake and the Glen Highway. Police determined the vehicle belonged to Adkins. Following an investigation that included field sobriety tests, Adkins was arrested and later released. Police say Adkins has been placed on administrative leave. He has been with the police department since 2016. Police declined further comment today, and additional details were not immediately available through online court records. Anchorage police began publicly releasing information on officers arrested for operating under the influence after the December 2023 arrest of Officer Ethan Copeland. Another officer, Aaron Richwine, was arrested and charged for OUI in November 2024. Anchorage teachers now officially have new contracts. The Anchorage School Board on Tuesday approved the agreement reached between the Anchorage School District and the teachers' union. The three-year contract increases salaries for roughly 2,800 teachers by 5% in each of the first 2 years and by 4% in the third. Plus, the contract retroactively gives teachers a 3% raise for the current school year. The finalized contract follows roughly 15 months of negotiations. Talks escalated in November when the union and district scheduled arbitration for the first time in nearly two decades. Negotiators for the union and district announced the agreement in mid-January, and union members voted to support the contract proposal last week. The agreement comes as the district approaches an uncertain financial future. Facing a projected budget deficit of about $90 million next school year, district officials recently proposed a budget that would cut more than 500 staff, increase class sizes, and eliminate many programs. Additionally, Anchorage voters will decide on a one-time, roughly $12 million tax hike to help support the school district in April. If approved, district leaders have committed to using all of the tax on teaching positions, estimating it would cover more than 80 educators. A celebrated Fairbanks cross-country skier is days away from competing in the 2026 Winter Olympic Games. 23-year-old Kendall Kramer has been training in Switzerland and Italy, where she says the atmosphere is intense but professional.
Well, I mean, the U.S. team holds easily some of the best skiers in the world, and so it's really cool to not kind of having these kind of rose-colored glasses around them, kind of seeing them as real people, which makes your own, like, skiing aspirations feel more attainable.
Kramer is one of eight Alaskans competing in the cross-country events. She previously represented Team USA at the 2020 Youth Olympics in Switzerland, earning silver and bronze medals. She's also a decorated national collegiate competitor. But before the world stage, there was home. Kramer said she cherishes her childhood memories of skiing at Birch Hill in Fairbanks. She went on to ski for West Valley High School and then for her alma mater, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where she graduated last year with a degree in biology and psychology. Even half a world away, Kramer says her mind is never far from the place that set her in motion.
It's harsh conditions and just a lot of hardy people and like can-do disciplined attitudes that I was around is to just be tough and do it anyway, even if it's hard and uncomfortable. And that really is a good recipe for an athlete, especially in cross-country skiing. So
Kramer says, however the games pan out, she's grateful for the opportunity to go. And it feels meaningful to race for more than just herself. She knows she's being watched by hundreds of fans, friends, and family members back in Alaska, and especially Fairbanks. The women's cross-country ski events start on Saturday morning, local time. Well, Christmas trees don't grow on the tundra around Nome, so each winter, residents ship them in to get into the holiday spirit. But by January, those trees need somewhere to go, and for the past few decades, locals have come up with a unique solution. KNOM's Ben Townsend has the story.
Sledful at a time, Charlie Lean ferries Christmas trees from the shore onto the frozen Bering Sea. With each bump on the chunky sea ice, the smell of evergreen trees faintly appears before a gust of coastal wind wipes it away.
I'll be back!
Almost every year since the mid-90s, locals like Lean have propped up their discarded Christmas trees into augured out holes in the sea ice, creating what is affectionately known as the Nome National Forest. It's ironic, considering the land around Nome is known for its spongy tundra, interrupted only by the occasional willow grove. Charlie Lean's got a bit of a limp these days, so his daughter Reba is taking care of the augering.
He's really taken it under his wing, and I think he just likes the quirkiness of it and knows that it's fun for visitors and around Iditarod time.
Reba trudges across the sea ice, occasionally piercing through the crunchy top layer of snow. The name of the game is to create a nice, even spread of holes so the forest looks prominent from town 100 yards away. After plopping the trees in, the holes are filled with snow and then doused in water, freezing and locking the trees in place.
We've got all the trees on site except two truckloads worth of animals arriving momentarily, and then we'll start ferrying out all the figures, and that's when the whole thing really pops.
An assortment of wooden signs resembling animals like seals, moose, and a dog team arrive on a sled.
Bunch of puffins and stuff. So really nice puffins. I'm really proud of those.
They're replacements for signs used in the Nome National Forest for decades. After some surprise ice breakup last year, those signs floated out to sea and were lost forever.
And I can't remember the actual weather event that sent the ice out, but I just, in disbelief, it's heartbreaking. And I'm sad because all those animals, they're nostalgic. There was like a mermaid that my girls loved.
Hours after getting started, the crew finally gets a chance to step back and take in their hard work. The months-old trees are missing a lot of needles, and being out here on the ice probably won't help. But Charlie Lean says nobody's judging.
We don't reject anybody, as long as it's a real tree. So, I mean, forests have woodpecker trees too, so we're not judging. We appreciate all these trees, yeah.
The Nome National Forest is open to visitors now until late winter, when Charlie Lean plans to be back out here plucking up the signs for next year. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Catherine Rose in Sitka, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Avery Elfelt in Haines, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, and Ben Townsend in Nome. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.